Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, ready for another election day? It kind of feels like we just went through an election cycle, and well, we did, kind of. Just after the general election in November of 2020, we had the recall of Governor Gavin Newsom almost a year later in September of 2021. And just 6 weeks from today, Tuesday, June 7th, California voters will be making their selection for a number of statewide and local races. One of them is California Attorney General. This was a position held a few years back by Vice President Kamala Harris. Most recently, it was Javier Becerra before he was nominated by President Joe Biden to be the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Last year, Governor Newsom appointed Rob Bonta, a state lawmaker from the Bay Area. Now, Bonta will face an election for a full term for the first time. So what does the attorney general do? The position is the state's top law enforcement officer, after all. CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon is here in studio to help us better understand this important position. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning.
So let's peel back the editorial curtain just a little bit. Why did you feel the need to focus on AG?
Well, it's a really important job. You know, the attorney general oversees this army of lawyers at the California Department of Justice. It's one of the larger state agencies. It has about 4,500 employees. Many of those are lawyers. And, you know, it's not necessarily an obscure state office. It is a very visible position. But I don't think many people, you know, myself included, until I started really digging into this, realize how much an attorney general can influence state policies and therefore influence our own lives.
Yeah, informally, it's been called the state's top cop. But what is the primary role of the California attorney general?
Right. They're often called this the state's top law enforcement officer, sometimes also called a state's attorney or the people's attorney. And both of those labels are true. You know, the person in this job, attorney general, first and foremost, ensures that state laws are being enforced. They oversee county sheriffs and district attorneys. That often can mean supporting those law enforcement agencies in doing their jobs. But it also means that the attorney general can say, hey, you're not enforcing the law correctly here, and this is what you should be doing. We've seen this recently when Attorney General Rob Bonta sent legal alerts on prosecuting cases of miscarriage or stillbirth as fetal murder. This was a case in the Central Valley. You know, women were sentenced and in one case put behind bars for fetal murder when it was a stillbirth. And Attorney General Rob Bonta said, this is not how this law was intended to be carried out. So stop doing that.
Right. Keep going, Nicole.
Well, it also means that the attorney general can file charges against cities or companies that aren't following the law. We see a lot of this with, you know, companies that might be breaking environmental laws, consumer laws. And then just one more thing worth mentioning on the attorney general's responsibilities. In recent years, the legislature has made this office responsible for investigating all incidents of deadly force involving police. So that law just went into effect last year, but the attorney general already has about a dozen pending investigations. No rulings on those yet, but, you know, that law was passed in hopes that it would bring greater oversight and accountability to police-involved killings.
Yeah, so clearly, as you just laid out, the AG doesn't make laws in California. That's over at the state capitol, the state legislature. But they're also charged with not only enforcing them, but allocating resources to them. How does that work?
Yeah, there's a lot of bandwidth here for the attorney general to decide how to spend state resources, whether it's investigation or enforcement. And this is really the space where I think an attorney general can carve out sort of an agenda or a legacy for themselves. So, for example, the most recent attorney general, Javier Becerra, was most well known for filing, you know, 123 lawsuits against the Trump administration, really challenging Trump's legal executive authority at every turn. And that took a lot of state resources. But Becerra also created within the State Department of Justice an Environmental Justice Bureau, which has focused specifically on investigating and protecting underserved communities, majority Black and Brown neighborhoods, from illegal pollution. And that has continued, he created it and it's continued to do that.
And as we know, Javier Becerra went on to a position appointed by President Joe Biden. Obviously, Kamala Harris is the vice president, also was AG. I appreciate the reminder in your article that Governor Jerry Brown was also an attorney general. And these are all high profile positions. So does this position allow to kind of a glimpse at what they're advocating for, or what they're prioritizing in terms of their agenda?
Totally. And I think, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that an attorney general's agenda can really heavily be influenced by what's happening, you know, statewide and nationally at the time. So, you know, we talked about Becerra obviously going after the Trump administration. Kamala Harris was elected attorney general in 2010. That was shortly after the 2008 mortgage crisis. She spent a lot of time investigating and prosecuting mortgage fraud in the aftermath of that in the years following. And another thing here is that, you know, while the attorney general is tasked with defending state law, they can choose not to aggressively do that. And an example here is when Jerry Brown was the attorney general and the state Supreme Court overturned Proposition 8, which had banned gay marriage or same-sex marriage, basically upholding same-sex marriage. And the attorney general the attorney general's job is to defend state law. So many might expect or wondered why Jerry Brown, as attorney general, did not appeal that. You know, that might be his job as attorney general. I think there was some, you know, sort of legal back and forth over that. People disagreed that Brown did not want to appeal that ruling. But, you know, that's his job as attorney general. He decided not to. And same-sex marriage became legal.
Yeah, and it was upheld. One of the top issues that has been discussed at length for this election, public safety, especially after so many tragic shootings like the one in downtown Sacramento earlier this month. How do you see this issue playing a role in the race for this midterms?
I mean, certainly this has already been a simmering debate in the past few years. But I think, you know, with this shooting so close to the state capitol, it's really kind of reached a tipping point. And already you had seen candidates running for attorney general, you know, talking about how they want to crack down, bring law and order, like enforce better, stricter, you know, sentencing laws and things like that. So I asked Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson what that might look like, you know, as we go through this race, and if California were to elect somebody that was very, like, tough on crime. And this is what she said.
We see it in terms of kind of which cases would be filed by the attorney general, which cases would they work with district attorneys on, and what would they push for in those cases? Would they push for the maximum sentence, for instance, or would they say, you know, we don't want to be in a state where we try minors as adults. We don't want to focus on drug cases, or we don't want to focus as much on petty theft and petty crimes. We just want to prosecute those, you know, quote unquote, bigger cases, more the violent crimes. And I think this is absolutely something that we're going to hear throughout the attorney general's race, which is, I think Bonta will say, you know, the way forward is to fix the injustices in our criminal justice system, to be more progressive, to try and end mass incarceration. And I think his opponents are going to say, we have to keep people safe, that all of that reform is great until we have a serious health and safety problem.
Yeah, and we're already hearing that divergence, you know, in this specific race, and we're going to get to the candidates in just a moment. What other issues do you think voters are really caring about as it relates to the attorney general?
Certainly, public safety is going to be front and center, I think, over the next few months. But there are a lot of other issues that the attorney general has oversight of. One thing that came up last week is that Advocates for Reproductive Rights gave a full-throated endorsement of Rob Bonta for re-election. They said he's been a very good advocate and made it clear that he supports expanding reproductive rights and access to abortion as other states move to restrict it. And they said they hadn't heard from other candidates about that. Environmental laws, you know, consumer laws. There's so much that this this official overseas that, you know, people might want to look into a little bit as they look at their ballots.
Yeah. And especially when talking about an issue such as reproductive rights, this is in response to what other states are doing, which leads me to the kind of like this idea. How does the attorney general's position intersect with national politics, and how integral is it to the job?
It's a very big part of the job for any attorney general. You know, anytime states file lawsuits against a White House, like we saw a lot of, you know, from California in the Trump years. Now we're seeing states like the attorney generals in states like Texas and Florida go and do those sort of challenges against the Biden White House. So there is this sort of antagonistic role for an attorney general to go after the decisions that a president of the opposite political party might be making. But you see smaller states, you know, sign on and support a lot of these lawsuits. For larger states like California, the role is really to lead a lot of those. And we definitely saw that with Javier Becerra's term as attorney general. But this role really is also seen as a launching pad. I mean, look at the three most recent attorneys general. Jerry Brown had been governor before, but was attorney general and became governor again. Kamala Harris went on to the Senate and then the White House as vice president. And now Javier Becerra finds himself in a cabinet position in the Biden White House after, you know, playing such an antagonistic role to former President Trump.
Yeah, especially given California has some 40 million residents and is the fifth largest economy in the world. That leads me now to Rob Bonta, the current attorney general appointed by Newsom last year. He's going to run his first campaign as an incumbent. Who are the top challengers?
So his challengers include two Republicans. Nathan Hochman is a former federal prosecutor. He was endorsed over the weekend by the Republican Party. There's also a Republican lawyer running. His name's Eric Early. He played a role in the recall Newsom campaign as an advisor. Sacramento County District Attorney, well-known figure here locally, is running as a no-party preference candidate, you know, really running on that tough-on-crime message and, it's, you know, tightening up the state's criminal justice laws and giving prosecutors more tools to keep violent offenders behind bars for longer, and running on her you know, record putting the Golden State Killer behind bars, for example. There's a Green Party candidate that has not done any fundraising, as far as I can tell. So all, and then Bonta, of course, you know, former state lawmaker, really seen as the liberal, you know, he's been grouped with the progressive district attorneys, you know, George Gascon in L.A. and Chesa Boudin in San Francisco, that are now, these two are, I think this is a really interesting issue to watch during this race, too, is that these progressive prosecutors came in. Things haven't gone so well for them the last couple years. They're facing recall challenges. And I think whether those are successful or not, it'll be interesting to see how that impacts these issues in the attorney general's races. So June 7th primary.
You know, given, Nicole, that obviously the governor is up for reelection, but it's not given that much coverage, given that there's not really, you know, viable candidates or fundraising, and we just had a recall last September, do you think that's turning more of a focus to the AG's race as being like one of the more hotly contested races for this midterm?
Certainly, I think that it feels like we did just have a governor's election in September that Newsom handily defeated. So I think that did take a lot of the air out of, you know, his challengers for the election in November. And I also just think that with the, you know, voters are becoming more concerned about crime. We're seeing that in polling. And we're at this moment now where I think people are starting to reevaluate the choices that California, you know, the legislature and voters have made on criminal justice and sentencing laws and all of that. I think the attorney general's race exemplifies or sort of illustrates this moment we're in. So it'll be really interesting to see how this race shakes out, and I guess just like how each candidate does and how these other issues affect how they campaign.
Yeah.
Over the next, you know, 2 months and a half before the primary and then into November.
6 weeks from today from the primary. Before we let you go, I want to just, you know, take a little detour. We're going to get an update on another issue that affects all of us, whether we drive a vehicle or we don't. Gas price relief. There are a number of bills that have been introduced since, you know, prices really just spiked at the onset of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Where do these bills stand? And does one seem to be bubbling to the top? Because it got a lot of attention earlier this year.
It did get a lot of attention. And it's interesting because I don't have much of an update for you because I don't think any of these bills have started to move. A few of them are in print. There is a deadline if by the end of this week, if lawmakers want to get this money into people to help people quickly, like they've said they wanted to, there's a deadline, you know, at the end of this week to pass those. But there, so the proposals we have are Governor Newsom has talked about rebates for people who drive cars, whether it's, you know, a gas-powered vehicle or an electric car. And he's put forth a proposal that includes that as well as 3 months of free public transit. Other lawmakers have talked about just $400 rebates across the board because rising gas prices has helped, you know, boost inflation. And everybody's feeling that whether you drive a car or not. Top lawmakers, the Speaker and the Senate President Pro Tem, have talked about wanting to be a bit more targeted and help people who have lower incomes, families. So I would expect if they want to get that money out to people by July that we might see some movement in the next few days here, but we'll have to see.
Yep. That's when you'll join us again, Nicole.
We'll see.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nicole Nixon is Cap Radio's political reporter. Up next, the Department of Water Resources discusses a new airborne technology to forecast groundwater during drought conditions. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. After a record dry start to the year, rain and snow made a welcomed return to the region this month. Spring rain soaked the valley and foothills, and the Sierra saw double the precipitation this month than they did in the previous 3 months combined. But the state is still in a severe drought, moderate to severe drought conditions as we head into the hottest, driest months of the year. As the climate continues to get hotter and drier, an accurate accounting of how much water lies in our snowpack and aquifers is vital to becoming more drought resilient while meeting the water needs of nearly 40 million Californians. California's Department of Water Resources is taking an innovative approach to this challenge by turning to the skies. DWR showed off its airborne technology at the Yolo County Airport yesterday as part of a focus on better forecasting our water future in a time of climate change and uncertainty. Joining us to talk about these technologies is Carla Nemeth, Director of the California Department of Water Resources. Director Nemeth, welcome to Insight. Good morning.
Good morning, Vicki. It's terrific to be here.
So DWR is investing in solutions to better understand groundwater. One of these solutions involves taking to the skies in a helicopter airborne electromagnetic surveys. How does this technology work and how will it improve groundwater management and drought resiliency?
Yes. So we had a terrific event out at the Yolo Airport showing off a little bit of this technology. I think what Californians need to understand is actually the water that's under our feet is an incredibly precious and important resource, particularly in times of drought. Typically, what happens when we see this very low precipitation and snowpack, about 60% of California's water then comes from water that's stored in the ground. So it's really important for us to understand where that water is moving and what's actually happening underground with all the different aquifers. And that's what this airborne electromagnetic survey technology is about. It's almost like an MRI for the Earth, where we send this imaging and it essentially bounces off the different soil types below our feet. And we can measure the resistance that different kinds of soil creates. And we take that information and then we essentially cross-check it with what we know by drilling wells in various locations. And what that does is it identifies soils that are porous and therefore very helpful for recharging groundwater basins, and soils that are more silty, like clays, which are not helpful for recharging groundwater basins. So this information is going to be very useful as we really lean hard into managing our groundwater basins for sustainability to help us understand where to put wells that can help us recharge those groundwater basins when we do get these bigger, flashier storm events like we had last week.
Yeah. Given that these aerial surveys, they began last summer, so a little over 6 months ago, is this technology being used elsewhere? I mean, how is DWR made aware of airborne electromagnetic surveys?
So absolutely. We're using it throughout the state. We're actually flying over about 100 different groundwater basins. We started in the Central Valley, the San Joaquin Valley, where, of course, groundwater conditions and overdraft is most acute. That's where we have the biggest sense of urgency to see these important corrections. But this is a technology that has been around for a little while. California actually is relatively new to managing its groundwater basins, but the rest of the country, frankly, was not. And so we knew that this technology existed, and we knew how important it would be as Californians and all of our local governments get really serious about making sure when the rain comes, we are proactively putting it into our groundwater basins to store it for these dry periods, of which we anticipate, you know, they will come more frequently and they will be longer in duration. So we're really going to need that groundwater.
Why did it take this long to turn the focus to groundwater, given California's extreme weather patterns and really drought-like conditions for several years now and a dwindling snowpack?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, there were really fits and starts at managing groundwater periodically. It was always a conversation that kind of cropped up during drought. But it really wasn't until the last drought when I think what started to happen was, especially in communities that are groundwater dependent, farmers and communities started to understand that ever deepening wells creates bigger problems in the long term. I think, and suddenly there was more of a sort of person on the street, if you will, understanding that it really matters to them what's happening, you know, 50 feet away or 100 feet away, two blocks away in the next community over. And we didn't have a way of knowing that because we had never managed our groundwater basins in an organized way in California. Some places in California did, particularly in Southern California, and then some places here in Northern California, in the Livermore area, for example. But it was largely because those water users, either they had, you know, extended dry conditions, They were planning for a drier future. Of course, Southern California has made a lot of different investments, managing groundwater basins, recycling water, because they had been experiencing drier conditions with a growing population for a long time. And it really wasn't until the last drought that I think the importance of that spread in a very acute way. And that's what really propelled us to get this legislation passed that requires Californians to manage their groundwater basins for sustainability. And we're giving folks a bit of a glide path. This is a challenge that's been developed over decades. So it's not something you can reverse overnight. But this new technology is a key to that, and it's going to help us dramatically understand where to put our investments and how to bolster these groundwater basins.
Given that these surveys began last summer and they were conducted in the state's described high to medium priority groundwater basins, you mentioned the Central Valley as one region. What have you learned so far?
Yeah, what we've learned through this, it's almost like an underground mapping exercise. And what we do is we run these surveys. It's a really cool, it's a helicopter that gets about 200 feet up, and then it sort of drags, if you will, about 100 feet above the ground, the sensors that sort of collect all this data. So now we'll have all this data. And what we do is it takes us about 12 to 18 months to process it. And that allows us to more precisely map where we think different soil types are. And then we provide that data and that information to all the local groundwater sustainability agencies. And it's available to the public as well. But those local groundwater agencies then take a look at that data and they match it with their own work, which is more manual, if you will. They groundwater agencies have been, you know, drilling test wells to understand, taking out core soil samples to understand what's below their feet. And what this does is it does it in a much more extensive way. And it also acts as a bit of a check for physical data that's been physically collected by these groundwater sustainability agencies. And what it'll do is it will help them plan and prioritize essentially groundwater recharge projects. But there's also a benefit of just better information around how water moves below our feet, because that's also part of what we're learning. It's difficult, you know, to collect good information about something if you're not managing it, right? I mean, that's the big challenge of not managing groundwater basins is we're doing two things at once. We're collecting a lot of information, but we're also needing to make big changes in how we manage it. So it's the classic kind of building the plane as you fly it, if you will. And this technology is a really essential part of the puzzle.
Yeah, I mean, I watched a video of it that's on DWR's website. And I have to say, it actually looks, it's basic, it looks quite, I guess, for lack of a better word, delicate. You know, when you see the instrument or the equipment that's kind of dangling from the helicopter, are there limitations of this technology? Can you just use it anywhere across the state?
That's a good question, and I don't know that. But what I do know is that the department we're not using it in urban areas or areas dairy cows and things like that. This is really, you know, there's sensitivities, of course, when you see, you know, big machinery flying over your property and trying to understand what it's doing and not doing and the kind of information that it's collecting. So we have been very sensitive to that and working with the community so that they know this is happening, they know what it's about, and they have access to this kind of information.
Yeah, a piece of this, as going off of that, is building relationships or working with tribal trust lands. What kind of work or relationships go into that to include these pieces of land into these surveys?
Yeah, that's a great question. So particularly out in Yolo, that's a terrific example. Their Groundwater Sustainability Agency has done a really terrific job working with farmers, working with community members, their cities in Yolo County that rely on groundwater, but also with the tribal nations. And so it's really through, and that's why local control for managing groundwater is so important. Because we really need these local government agencies to make sure that they are connecting with all folks in their communities, but specifically tribal nations, given the sovereign to sovereign relationship that that we have with them.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with DWR Director Carla Namath about the department's airborne technology to survey groundwater basins. The agency is embracing a shift away from a reliance on historical patterns to really modernizing forecast data collecting. What was missing that led to what is really a fundamental shift?
I think, well, on the overall forecasting topic, there's really two ways in which we're working on it. And we've just been talking about really important technologies that help us understand groundwater. And to understand the scale, you know, we all get very focused on reservoir levels when we have a drought, and that's very important. But, you know, most people don't know that we have actually 10 times the water storage capacity underground than we do for surface water reservoirs. So this kind of technology is very important. I think the other piece of technology that we have developed is something called INSAR. And what that does is it helps us use satellite imaging to measure subsidence, because that's another key indicator of a groundwater basin that's not in a healthy condition. Now, where we have places, you know, in particular in the Central Valley, where we have deep subsidence that's occurred over many decades, there are groundwater basins that can recover, and they some of them typically do somewhat when we see a subsidence in a drought, and then we have a big rain event. So after 2017, we did see some of the groundwater basins rebound a little bit, but not all of them do. And so that kind of information, that kind of satellite imaging that allows us to measure with precision subsidence that's occurring, it really alerts us to different hotspots in the state. It alerts us to, you know, potential challenges that we might have with community wells or drinking water wells, and it allows us to deploy resources to help those communities. So one example is last year, and certainly this year too. It's extraordinarily dry in the Sacramento Valley in ways in which we have not seen. And so, again, typically what folks will do is they will start to rely on their groundwater basins. And when everybody is pumping, then we start to see groundwater levels decline, and potentially we see subsidence. And that's what we saw start to emerge last year in the Sacramento Valley. And again, that helps us for this year, which will be even drier, to go in and work with those communities. They do have groundwater sustainability agencies that are, you know, didn't exist in the previous drought, but they do now. And so we now just have a lot better local government sort of architecture, if you will, to help us be responsive to conditions as they develop during a drought, and really deploy resources to make sure that, one, everyone can have enough water to drink and to use during the drought in a limited way, but also help us identify the projects and programs that we need to reverse that trend over time, which is, of course, going to take it's going to take a while longer.
Yeah. And given that, this month, the state, y'all ramped up your water conservation public awareness campaign. You even brought in, you know, social media influencers to try and persuade Californians to use less water. Last July, Governor Newsom called for Californians to reduce their water use by 15%. But in February, they saved less than 1%. Was that surprising to you? And what are the long term consequences of this?
Yeah. So I wouldn't say I was surprised. And I was not surprised because we had such extraordinarily warm temperatures in February and March. And so that is, you know, traditionally a period where it's, you know, past practices, when it's dry, people go out and they actually put more water on their yard. So 50% of of urban use is actually outdoor use. Another 8% is essentially leaks that need to be fixed. But we are very focused on that outdoor use. And I think that's what's really driving the conservation numbers is when we experience warm ambient temperatures, a lot of people who, you know, that's their trigger to actually go use more water. And conversely, in December, Californians used a lot less water. We met those conservation goals fairly easily, voluntarily. And again, that's largely because people turn off their sprinklers. So we're going to have to reverse that trend. And the governor, that's part of what our Save Our Water campaign is about, really focused on those outdoor water uses. The governor did direct local water districts to enter into their stage two of their drought contingency planning. So that was something that occurred in the last drought, was a renewed emphasis on local water districts creating their own drought contingency plans, because conditions vary significantly across the state in terms of precipitation, in terms of available water supplies. Some folks have invested significantly in recycled water and in other kinds of water. But the governor did direct those water agencies to enter into that stage of their drought contingency plans. And that includes about 20% water conservation. So I think what we're going to start to see over the summer, and probably very soon here, because a lot of these water districts will want to get out in advance of, you know, even warmer temperatures coming, we are going to start to see more mandatory water restrictions, in all likelihood on outdoor watering, because it works and it really conserves water in, you know, the quickest way possible. I mean, we saw last year the city of Healdsburg, places like, you know, Sonoma and Mendocino County and Marin, when folks are faced with the potential for a significant water supply challenge, these local water districts do step up and they do respond, and we see that kind of conservation. Now, we do have, we did pass legislation in 2018, California did, called Conservation as a Way of Life. And that is really a three-pronged approach to water use efficiency, the next generation of water use efficiency, both indoor, outdoor, and then again, fixing significant leaks, what we call water loss. And it's all of those things together that will create water budgets in California, so people can have the maximum amount of flexibility, but they know what it means to use water efficiently. And that is coming with a lot of 2030 deadlines, so that we're prepared for the next drought. So water use in California over time, our demand is going to need to go down. People are going to need to use water more efficiently, and we can have a terrific, thriving state. In fact, I think that's what it takes for us to have a thriving communities and a thriving state, is if we use water more efficiently into the future. It helps our communities. It helps our environment.
Yep. There are a lot of arms to this. Director Nemeth, thank you for taking the time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Carla Nemeth is the director of the California Department of Water Resources. Still ahead, 50 years ago, Apollo 16 landed on the moon. We'll have a conversation with a living moonwalker from that mission. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. 50 years ago, 1972, Apollo 16 astronauts successfully landed on the moon. And that includes Brigadier General Charlie Duke, who was one of four living moonwalkers. And he spoke with Dave Schlom, the host of Blue Dot at North State Public Radio, as part of Dave's ongoing Apollo at 50 series. Dave has a pretty cool story to share with us and joins us now. Good morning, Dave.
Hi, Vicky. Nice to be with you.
So you're the creator of Blue Dot and also just a widely respected space history journalist. Where did this passion come from?
Well, you know, a lot of kids when they're growing up, especially back in the 60s, wanted to be astronauts. Well, I didn't. I watched those guys on TV that were the journalists like Walter Cronkite and Frank McGee. And I wanted that job. So all these years later, I get to do something very much like that. And it's just a real joy.
So you spoke with Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, and you're commemorating the 50th anniversary of Apollo 16 lunar landing. What stands out to you about Charlie Duke and also just overall the Apollo 16 mission?
Well, I got to talk to Charlie and his son, Tom, who's also a very accomplished pilot, flies airlines, is an airline pilot. And what struck me was just how extraordinary they are in one sense, and at the same time, how ordinary and wonderful and just warm they are. So the Apollo astronauts, when you get to know them and the people from that era, they're just kind of like guys you would go play golf with or go fishing with. And then when you get to talking to them, you find out they did these just extraordinary things.
So you're going to share a particularly fun and really unique treat during the Apollo 16 mission, Charlie Duke's love of country music. I'll let you take the lead. But first, were you surprised about this development?
Well, I knew a bit about it. And then recently, a new song came out called Charlie Duke Took Country Music to the Moon. So there's been a renewed interest in it. But what was really surprising was after interviewing the general, as Tom, his son, and I like to call him, I go out to my mailbox and here's a package with the music in it. When I put it in my CD player and listened to it, it was just a revelation. When the Apollo astronauts were on their way to and from the moon, they all took personal cassette tapes of music to help pass the hours of flipping switches, monitoring systems, and getting ready to explore the moon from the surface and in orbit. On Apollo 16, Charlie Duke was no exception. Although, as you'll hear, his mixtape turned out to be exceptional.
Well, I like country music, and so several of us in the space and office did. Pete Conrad was a country music fan, and Stu Russo was, and so we got to take country music. And so I called a disc jockey friend of mine, Bill Bailey, up in KIKK in Pasadena, Texas. I said, "Bill, give me some country music." He said, "You got it." So a couple of weeks before the flight, these cassettes show up, and he said, "Now, look, don't listen to these until you get airborne." So I said, "Okay, we're on the way to the moon," and I plugged in one of these cassettes, and it was...
You have just punched your Bailey button. This is Bill Bailey. And to all you guys, to you, Charlie especially, and John and Ken... And anybody else you got up there with you, we got about 2 hours of real good entertainment lined up for you. This is side number one, and I'd like to ask that you play all of the tapes in sequence because we have, you know, want to keep it all a surprise for you until you get time to listen to it all the way through. They're all great tapes. There'll be a minimum of interference from me. We've got four of the greatest artists, actually five great artists in the country music business today that are all set to entertain you for two solid hours. I don't know if you'll get to listen to them all together or piecemeal fashion, but you'll enjoy them. But do listen to the tapes. Number one, two, three, four in order, because I think you'll enjoy much more that way. So without further ado, here's the Porter Wagoner Show.
Oh, Mama, I'm excited. I'm almost out. Porter Wagoner and Dolly Parton. We got a half-hour program for you and Ken and John, and hope y'all enjoy it.
And yeah. Colonel Duke, Captain Young, and Commander Mattingly, this is the biggest show of the Wagon Masters and Miss Dolly and my of our entire lives. The longest distance from home of any show that we have ever played, and the smallest crowd that we have ever played for, but the most important audience in the world and outer space. And this show is one of the highlights of my career and the most significant of my career also. There's no way to put in words how the Wagon Masters, Speck, Dolly, and I really feel this second to be able to share in the smallest way this historic mission and to be able, through the sound of music, to be a part of it and all of you gentlemen aboard. So I hope you will enjoy the songs and each thing that we put down for you. Now here is a beautiful little lady to sing one of her big hit songs that I know you will enjoy, titled Joshua, Miss Dolly Parton.
Thank you, Paul.
Yes.
Well, a good ways down the railroad track, there was this little old rundown shack, and in it lived a man I'd never seen. Folks said he was a mean and a vicious man, and you better not set foot on his land, but I didn't think nobody could be that mean.
So they sang and told jokes and tales for a half hour just for us.
By the way, Colonel Duke, if any of you gentlemen happen to spot a feller up there somewhere named Howard Hughes, tell him that his life story is ready anytime he wants to go ahead and live it.
Porter, I have a message for Colonel Duke, too.
You have a message for Colonel Duke?
Right.
Okay.
Colonel Duke, this is a message from your wife, Dorothy. She just wonders if you'd mind throwing down the car keys so she can take your two boys, Charles and Thomas, to the movies. Wasn't that pitiful?
Oh, well, if them boys wants to go to the movie, well, I just pitch them keys out and they'll get them.
They'd probably rather go to the moon, though, wouldn't they?
I would imagine, yes. And, Colonel Duke, we were really thrilled when we heard that you were a country music fan. And you're, of course, from the great state of North Carolina, and I've played many, many shows there and have so many country music fans. But little did I ever realize that one of them would be taking our music to the moon.
It was all just for us. And the next guy was Merle Haggard, and he did the same thing, a whole half hour just for us.
Here's Merle Haggard.
This is something a little different for me. My name is Merle Haggard, and this is my band, The Strangers. And I hope that we will be able to do something you'll enjoy hearing on your way to the moon. And, of course, we hope that you come back. But we want you to leave this tape there, okay? We want this tape to be out of sight.
And then Buck Owens was the third entertainer, and his program was the same.
Hey, my name is Buck. And we're Charlie and John and Ken, as you're sailing along in the silver blue, we got together here and we're just going to do a little thing. This is kind
glad
of
we're aboard with you on Apollo 16, and they talked to us and told jokes and sang songs. And the last 30 minutes was Chet Atkins and Jerry Reed. And they had a similar program. So it was very, very entertaining.
Hello, Charlie, Ken, and John. This is Chet Atkins and Jerry Reed in Nashville, Tennessee, and we're very happy to say hello to you by this tape recording.
We all liked it, just the fact that they were talking to us and telling jokes and singing their favorite songs back in those days. And so when I got back, I gave those original recordings to the Country Music Hall of Fame and became fairly good friends with Buck Owens and Merle Haggard, and was introduced to him in the country music special award he got, and with Buck Owens. And anyway, we got a new neighbor in our neighborhood here in New Braunfels where I live, and named Randy Rogers. He's a country music star. So he listened to these tapes and he said, "Charlie, I'm going to write a song about that." I said, "Have at it." So he wrote this cute little country music song called Charlie Duke Took Country Music to the Moon.
My name is Merle Haggard, and we want to dedicate this especially to Charlie Duke. He was the one who asked for the tape, and of course, the other two fellas are invited to listen. Unless you have separate compartments, maybe you can get away from it. And we hope you all get back safe.
I mean, it was really funny and really good. He and Robert Earl Keane did put that on an album.
When Charlie Duke was a little bitty baby, said, I want to be a pilot, and his daddy said, maybe if you work real hard and you never play the fool.
Next thing you know, he's in a T-38, flying up and down and all over the place, so they signed him up and they sent him off to astronaut school.
Now, he was just a boy from the Palmetto State who ended up in outer space, but he liked his music country, and that, friends, is pretty cool.
Doyle, you said you, what'd you say you didn't
school? I wanted to be an astronaut a long time ago when I was a little boy.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I took up space in school.
Took up space in school.
I've gotten a lot of fun out of it. I still listen to those tapes. Tom likes country music. Most of my grandkids like country music. And so we get a lot of fun listening to those things and then enjoying country music together.
Dave, I can hear all the fun you had with that one.
Yeah, you know, the real joy of doing my program is getting to know the people and the human stories behind these incredible historic missions to the moon, because it's the human side of it and getting to know the people that makes it meaningful and, for me, really fun.
Well, that is Dave Shlom, the host of Blue Dot at North State Public Radio. We have a link to Dave's show as well as other programs that he offers part of the show as host. Thank you so much for joining us and spending time with us this morning.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
And we were chatting about the Apollo at 50 special, about the fifth lunar landing mission, Apollo 16, back in 1972. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. Before we go, we do have some news to pass along. Vice President Kamala Harris's office announced that the vice president has tested positive for COVID-19. Harris is not showing symptoms and will isolate at home. The VP is not considered to be a close contact to President Biden, given their different travel schedules. NPR, of course, will have more on this throughout the day. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.